Welcome to Theatre Voice. My name's Heather Neal, and I'm joined by two regulars at Shakespeare's Globe, Philip Cumbus and James Garnon. Welcome to you both, and thanks for coming between a matinee and an evening performance. Well, you've both been in numerous Shakespeare's and several contemporary plays here. Phil, as well as appearing in plays by Jack Sheppard and Che Walker, you've been Bassanio in The Merchant of Venice, Claudio in Much Ado, Ferdinand in Love's Labour's Lost, Malcolm and then Macbeth in Macbeth, and Mercutio in Romeo and Juliet. And these last two roles also being played at the Globe by James Garnon, who has also been Caliban in The Tempest, Parolles in All's Well, both Richmond and the Duchess of York in the all-male Richard III, as well as James I in Howard Brenton's Anne Boleyn, and last summer Dr. Scroggy in Brenton's Dr. Scroggy's War. I'm sure I haven't mentioned all your roles, and of course you've both played in other theatres as well. You're not exclusively Globe players, but suffice it to say you're both very experienced here. And you're both now in John Ford's 'Tis Pity She's a Whore, directed by Michael Longhurst, in the candlelit Sam Wanamaker Playhouse. Phil plays the villainous, scheming Spaniard Vasquez, and Jimmy both the hilariously doltish Burghetto and the vicious Cardinal, much cooler character at the end. Well, let's start by talking about the difference for an actor between playing in the Globe and the Playhouse. The Globe, of course, outside, where there's rain, helicopters, distractions of all sorts, 1,500 people, some of them standing. Inside, much more intimate, candlelit, 350 people only, and just concentration, no distractions. So, Phil, first, what difference does that make to your relationship with the audience?
It feels very delicate in there. There's a sort of, you get a slight sense with the audiences at the Globe when they come, that there's a sort of, they come, or certainly the ones who head to the front of the stage in the yard, that they're sort of up for it. There's a sort of energy that they bring, which in the Wanamaker I find is just, it's slightly more delicate and held, and they're not quite sure what their role is in that room in the same way necessarily. They don't know, I think, what we're going to, how we might treat them. In a way that I think at the Globe there's a sort of, maybe it's just because the Globe has been going for a bit longer so people know how it works, whereas in there it feels much more delicate and poised, and it's really beautiful to feel that. And you've got, you know, because of the makeup of the stage being different, the pit, and people are sat and they're really cramped together, there's a it means that it's got all the beauty of the Globe and all the energy, but somehow it's just sort of siphoned in and squeezed together much much more compactly and intensely. So it's a really intense atmosphere, because I suppose the lack of the opening in the roof that sort of explodes the energy of the Globe out, this one is much more held, like a sort of candle flame like quality to it. So it's really delicate and really beautiful to play.
Jimmy, what about you? Because comedy is one of your strengths, and you're playing a very funny character in this. What's the relationship with the audience like in terms of comedy? Because you're also used to playing comedy on the Globe stage.
I don't really know. I was certainly nervous about it. Not that nervous, because I had seen Knife of the Burning Pestle. Had I not seen that and seen how happily comedy worked in that space, I think I might have been a bit more apprehensive. But the curious thing, I couldn't speak generally, but what I find interesting doing this comic part is that I don't really, and I tend to play with the audience, you know, I tend to think in both spaces what we should be doing is playing with the audience rather than for or at them. But curiously in this piece I'm not. I don't really acknowledge them, don't look at them. I think there's something to do with the writing, that Burghetto is so concerned with whoever else is on the stage and doesn't know what he thinks until somebody else tells him, that I don't really interact with them. I don't have any soliloquy. It's interesting in this play that the villains all have soliloquies, or it's interesting that soliloquies are very sort of sparsely shared out. Grimaldi has a lot of talking with the audience, which seems very strange that he's not a very large part, but he speaks mostly to the audience. Burghetto is on a lot, doesn't talk to the audience once, doesn't have a single aside or anything. So in that respect, I don't know, except that...
What about catching the eye? What about catching the eye of individuals in the audience? Can that still happen here?
Yeah, of course it can. And indeed, sure, I just don't do it. I just realise that I'm not really... I know there are opportunities where I could do it, but I'm choosing not to because I don't think that I kind of need to taste the thing, or it would start slipping into something else, and one wants the comedy to be very broad but also keep it within the world. So although I'm going very far, I don't really want to tip that far. I'm happily falling into the audience and using them but not really being aware of them because they're not relevant to me. That also relates to, you know, lots of other scenes where the ghetto seems to forget who's in the room or forget, you know, he's myopically concerned with what's happening now, so there's no need to play out the words. But having said which, I do think that's the similarity between both spaces, is that you are nevertheless more conscious of the audience than you would be in any other space because they're there lit in the same light. It's just in my character the audience are as irrelevant as all the other characters. So they relate to the other characters in that way.
Yeah. They do seem, I mean, I do quite a lot of diaries written this, and they do seem slightly more reticent in there to be spoken to. You know, I think they feel more exposed, you know, because they're fewer. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned them not being sure what their role was. And there is a role for the audience in the Globe to play, isn't there? They feel like a character, the audience in the Globe. Yeah, but it's not quite the same in the...
Maybe by the end of the evening they're sort of warmed up to it. But certainly it feels, the first few asides I have, and it feels like it takes longer to sort of drag them into the sort of messiness of the play in a way that at the Globe somehow you sometimes have to fight to keep them away from the play a little bit. You know, you have to judge that balance really finely, whereas in there it's partly the shadow of the theatre as well, I think, does that, whereas the Globe, even of an evening, the light is very democratic in there, you know, whereas in here it doesn't feel as democratic. The audience are shadowed, and as are we. And so I think that creates a sort of caution in them, which is really lovely to feel, because it's a play that sort of descends, you know. Yeah. So it's nice to... But certainly when you look at people, sometimes they are more quick to look away or feel a bit uncomfortable with it, which I've never much encountered at the Globe.
I think that's because the Globe, the audience impose themselves on the space. The architecture seems to let the audience inform the atmosphere of the show, the atmosphere, whereas here the candlelight and the you know, that subduedness imposes an atmosphere on all of us that we then work against. So the architecture just operates slightly differently in that sense, but we nevertheless, in the same way as telling a story with the audience in the Globe, we're telling a story with the audience in the Wanamaker. So in the Globe you have external things like aeroplanes and weather and things to be concerned with, which we all have to deal with together to tell the story. And in the Wanamaker, you have this peculiar, you know, sexy, flickery atmosphere that you're all sort of operating and telling the story through and with.
What about the technical differences in preparation? Obviously, you use your voice in a much different way, presumably. I mean,
a little bit, yeah. I mean, I've been surprised, and it's sort of difficult to tell in oneself, really. The audience will know better than me, but it doesn't feel much less energised as an acting style than it does on the Globe. And that feels quite odd, because when you imagine the Globe, it is massive, and the stage is massive. But actually, it doesn't feel any less energised. You can... The extremes you can go to maybe vary. Like, there are definitely moments in this where, you know, like you have the privilege of really drawing them in, but I think you've got to... It's partly because it's dark, isn't it? You know, so the audience, when they can't see you that well, I think you need therefore to still be really articulate, really dexterous and energised with the voice. Otherwise, the slight blurriness of the vision means you connect with the words less well. So in a way, you're working just as hard, I think.
What about you, Jimmy? Has it made any difference to the way you prepare? Physically, I mean, technically, voice and movement.
No, but I think experience, you sort of rely on your experience to a point. You know, it's the same as calling for a dog or shouting at somebody in the street. You use the amount of volume that you require to reach the target. So I think internally it doesn't feel any different. You know what I mean? You sort of you taste the size of the room and go instinctively to that. But I'm not... so one's approach is the same.
Uh-huh, okay.
You know what I mean? But yeah, the effect may be different, but that's not something we can necessarily judge.
One thing that's definitely different is the candlelight. I mean, and in this particular production, there's a lot of carrying of candles as well as having them coming down above you and going up again and being extinguished and lit again. Do you find that distracting in any way, or does it help the atmosphere?
Well, I, in this, it's sort of difficult to sort of split on it. Not, I'm not splitting on production, but when we did Malfi last year, we used the candles very realistically. That is to say, if we were outside, we didn't have candles. If we were at night, we did. It was all determined by that. I think Michael has gone something slightly different, and he's using them in a much more... He's very insistent that the scenes between Giovanni and the friar, they have candlelight. I know that there are people coming out with candelabra into what is obviously a street scene where Phil and Phil Pascoe and Grimaldi are fighting in the street, and the characters come out from outside with candles, but clearly we're not. So it's not being used literally in that sense, because they don't need candlelight, because these men are able to fight. So it's much more, he's using them to create effects and maybe increase certain levels of light on characters. They're not being used literally in the same way that they were.
He's thinking on sort of theatre level, isn't he?
Yeah.
Thinks, you know, you need to be lit in order to be able to be seen. Therefore, you bring it on, where, as opposed to a sort of logic from within the play itself.
Mm. Mm. But there's a lot more business to do with them as well, isn't there? The raising and lowering of them and extinguishing of them while acting is going on. Is that?
I think Michael's just concerned with the aesthetic. It's semi-practical to create light, but I think he also just likes the aesthetic of the candles and wants to get the most out of them that he can and play with them. And that's, you know, I'm not remotely saying that it's not as valid as doing something.
Mm.
And obviously when Dominic opened with Malfi, it was the first time he did it, so I think he was very keen on not experimenting in the fullest sense, but experimenting in a very narrow sense of saying, well, what would they have done?
Mm-hmm.
And but I, for my part, don't have any dealings with the candles in this show, which was a semi-personal choice because I didn't want the faff of dealing with. I also ran up and down a lot.
Yes.
And
I carry them a lot. I'm playing a servant, so I sort of found them really useful as a sort of prop that you can get better and better at using. You know, to begin with, it feels very stiff and awkward, and you feel slightly lumbered with it, and you get burnt a lot and they're going out. But actually all those floors become quite useful as you're going along. Tonight we did, this afternoon in the matinee, I had a candle in one scene go out twice, and so you have to sort of, you know, relight them within the scene, and that's that sense of ownership over a thing that your character would be using all the time, and, you know, that would just be a part of, you know, an extension of their own body is really satisfying. So I found it very useful, and I love seeing the way it looks. You know, I am constantly within the play and within a scene and within a character's framework, there is a bit of me that still sort of goes, this looks amazing. You know, when I'm looking at other people on stage, or I see the chandeliers descend, and, you know, it's really strikingly powerful and atmospheric, and that's a useful sort of freshness that you get within a performance.
Well, I think the time has come to try and have a go at the plot. I'm not going to attempt the whole thing because it's extremely convoluted.
Yes.
But we've got to say what you are in it, so I'm going to have a go. The premise is that a brother and sister, Annabella and Giovanni, have fallen in love, and their affair, their deciding that they're going to be together, whatever happens, is from that most things flow.
Mm.
And you, as Vasquez, are the sort of stage manager of most of the events that occur, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Annabella has various suitors, of whom Berghetto is one, the foolish person, but there's also a rich man called Soranzo, who is Vasquez's...
he's my boss.
He's your boss, yes. Yeah. He's your... you're his servant. He's another suitor, and then there's Grimaldi as well, another suitor. Grimaldi at one point decides he's going to kill Soranzo in order to get to Annabella. He thinks this is the best thing to do, and in the dark he kills Berghetto by mistake. So Berghetto is out of the picture. You then come in again, but you're now the cardinal.
Who is Grimaldi's
sponsor.
Right, yes. Mm. Everybody's connected in some way or other, aren't they? And there's far more to the plot than I've just given. but we don't need it all for now, I think. So, Vasquez, let's start with you, Phil. Yeah. He seems to be completely unreconstructed. Have you found good things about him? Is he, in some sense, a moral centre, or is he just a bad person?
No, I think I found constantly. I think he does some pretty disgraceful things, but it's all driven from this slightly absurd level of loyalty that he has, and duty, and honour, and honesty. He's existing in this world that is ludicrously corrupt. Mm. And
we should perhaps say that it's set in Parma, but you're a Spaniard, so you're a bit of an outsider.
Yeah, at the end, there's a sort of Vasquez volunteers information about his upbringing and how he came to Parma, and that he's actually a Spaniard, but actually what he has done, he believes he's done because he's a loyal servant, you know, and he does violent things and he does horrible things, but he, in a way, has an incredibly rigid and beautifully sort of centered sense of who he is and what he believes in and what he thinks is right and wrong and what he thinks should be punished or not.
But having tricked Annabella's servant, Putana, into saying who the father of her unborn child is, that's to say her brother, you then have the servant blinded. Now, that's a bit de trop, isn't it?
It is, but I think it's a really exciting moment in the play because you get a real sense that the audience, and that's part of the joy of doing this play a lot, is that they don't know it very well. So you really sense that the play sort of drops into something really surprising. So it's a really shocking moment when he suddenly goes, right, put out her eyes. But he does it, he believes in his role as a servant. He does, and he thinks that she is a disgraceful servant. She's just given up the information of her boss. You know, she's supposed to be this sort of the holder of everything, all the secrets. And I've, you know, chatted to her for a bit and got her to trust me, and she's volunteered this awful information about her lady. So for me, that represents everything that is flawed about being a servant.
Is it also because of what she has seen and gone along with?
Partly, yeah. I mean, it is a response to the sort of massiveness of the information that she says. You know, she says the father of the child is the brother, which is shocking. But I think his viciousness comes from something else. Because actually, there's some sort of enjoyment in the massiveness of the knowledge that he then goes on. It's sort of almost like he feels for the first time he's the sort of play he's in. Do you know what I mean? It's much bigger and more Jacobean than he ever imagined. It's suddenly... I couldn't even believe this was coming. So there's a sort of weird pleasure in that, and I think the violence comes from something more dismissive about how rubbish she is, and it makes him feel bad about being a servant, the way that she behaves. Ooh. And so he then vents that sort of self-hatred upon her somehow.
Now, Baghetto, he's such fun and a relief for all of us, really, because he is such fun. But he lives in a very corrupt world, doesn't he? I mean, there isn't much good to be said about this world, really. And then he gets killed by accident. I mean, tell us a bit, for a start, about what that's like, because it is pitch black when that happens, isn't it? And it's very believable, because you can't see what's going on. You seem not to be able to. We certainly can't, so... It's very believable, that.
It's funny, isn't it? Because I'm sure that's why we've done it in pitch black, so it's more believable that the other character mistakes who it is. But, of course, it's on another level entirely theatrical, because the man who creeps up behind us is talking all the time. He's creeping up behind us, telling us that he's about to kill them. And so, on another level, it's completely theatrical as well. It's not... it's funny what we choose to think is realistic and what we choose to ignore.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's, you know, it's no more... It's sort of preposterous. But it is lovely having that sort of pitch blackness I don't know what to say about it. I mean, that's what happens.
You've been described by one critic as like Hugh Laurie, by another as being a bit like Boris Johnson, and somebody else as being Worcesterish. But you're none of these things, really, are you? You're just extremely funny.
And these things and all of these things.
And
there are moments where I know that I'm doing certain sorts of things and deliberately referencing things. And yeah. you know, quite deliberately. But really, what he is innocence. He is the innocent in the play, and I kept thinking of Dostoevsky's Idiot as a sort of point of reference, because Begetto actually is right in thing mistaking Annabella for a whore, because as far as he's concerned, that's they're buying. Donardo is buying this wife for him. The whole suit of transaction is a financial transaction. It's as much as it is anything else, and Begetto seems to understand it on that level. And when he falls in love honestly and truthfully with somebody else, and is prepared to dismiss absolutely everything else in pursuit of this very pure and innocent love, which we have been led to believe Giovanni and Alabella's is, but we realise slowly that it isn't. And there's something very innocent about what's going on there. It's, you know, if we choose to treat it that way, we're kidding ourselves, and we're more in love with romantic love than we should be, which I think is one of the points of the play, because it's one of the points of Romeo and Juliet. You know, we get suckered into sympathising with these characters, but really there's something a bit, and certainly in this relationship, something deeply wrong, and innocence dies, and that's what Begetto represents in the same way that Mercutio dies, to represent something else there. And Philotas, who is love, Philo is, you know, I think they would have definitely seen these characters as slightly emblematic. And Begetto, the root of Begetto is Beget. And he says, I will beget a race of wise men, and that's a very funny sort of joke. But it's a reminder, in what sense is Begetto the Begetto? Well, he's the Begetto in that he is innocence. And the beginning of this tragedy is innocence. And the first victim is innocence. The second victim, you know. So he has a sort of emblematic function. The difficulty is trying to keep these balls in the air whilst also be entertaining, whilst also serving, you know.
So it's an irony that the moral centre is the fool, as it were.
Yeah, and whether or not we get that or not, I don't. But you know.
Well, then you go off and you come on as this awful cardinal. What's that like? I mean, do you do a lot of changing of character while you're off stage, a lot of sort of, or is it just change of garments and that does it for you?
Yeah. Change garments, lower tone, don't move your face so much. pretty much all that happens. But it's interesting, I do think, I mean, it makes you wonder whether or not they were the original double. I can't but imagine that they were, because that's just very convenient. And it creates a very definite effect. It immediately says the comedy's over.
Yeah.
And it's a very definite way of saying innocence is now gone. If you take the one true innocent and turn that same face into something far harsher.
Yes, because he should be the moral centre, and he's
most
not,
decidedly
definitely
not.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
Well, it's, as we've said, an extremely complicated plot. I presume, Phil, that during rehearsals, clarity was one of the main things you were aiming for.
It was, yeah, but it was also one of the biggest obstacles, I think, as well. There was, with all these plays, they are knotty and difficult, and Ford, like Shakespeare, plays hugely with time frames and time scales, and actually trying to make total logical sense of the time frames and what people are doing and where they've been and what's happened in between scenes or every act was actually really difficult, because it was slightly impossible. At the end of the play, Giovanni talks about 9 months having passed, and there's sort of no way when you look back that actually that could have happened in any way. But, you know, you sort of buy it as you go. So, yeah, clarity certainly on a general level was quite difficult to obtain, but what you're looking for is total clarity in what it is you're saying, really, and that's always very satisfying to work through, you know, these brilliantly evocative, powerful, brutal language that Ford uses, and just really gaining ownership of that over the course of the first few weeks of rehearsal is really, really satisfying.
Very different from Shakespeare.
Yeah, it is different. It's difficult to know why. It just feels, it's very immediate, it's very muscular, it feels, it's very instant and fast, and it sort of trips along, and the play has a sort of brilliantly clear and rapid structure that I think feels different to me, the way the different strands piece together, the way you get a little bit of this and it sort of ramps up, whereas you always feel with Shakespeare sometimes that he's doing the opposite. He sort of takes the more conventional structure and will do something a bit funny with it, or, you know, he'll change direction somehow before Act 5 or something, whereas you feel with this that you're launching towards a sort of inevitable finish right from the first scene, which is really, really satisfying to play.
Well, Jimmy mentioned Romeo and Juliet just now, and you've both been in Romeo and Juliet, and this is a sort of vicious version of Romeo and Juliet, isn't it? Is it sort of was that something you talked about in rehearsals?
Not essentially, I don't think. I mean, it's not it wouldn't be helpful to necessarily reference it. I don't know, but it is interesting. I mean, it is again. It's not an original thought or point, but I mean, lots of people have compared it to or thought of it as an answer. But it is interesting that they're all the same characters are there. You've got a nurse, you've got a friar, you've got a pair of star-crossed lovers. In effect, you know, when you've got a father, and the way Begetto dies and the timing of his death is exactly analogous with Mercutio's, and you know, it is a darker world. It's a different town and a different sort of thing. But he clearly is semi-referencing it. He's clearly very conscious about the story being there. And part of me, as I said, you know, I think it is a sort of when you think they're star-crossed. I'll really give you something to think about. And I think it is asking the same question. You know, we're so in love with Romeo and Juliet, we forget how they might have appeared initially and how young and foolish and rushed their relationship is and what attitudes towards this you know, these children making the decision of who they're marrying and how people would have viewed that. And, you know, but people want to love them and want to go with them. And Ford's going, OK, well, if you love them and want to go with them, well, how about these ones? Do you want to love and go with these guys? And there's something analogous, but wouldn't it be helpful for us in rehearsals? Unless you were doing it in conjunction, you were doing the two. But it wouldn't be great to see the plays done concurrently with the same cast and just swap them over, because it'd be easy peasy. Yeah. You know? I don't know what Vasquez would be, I expect he's sort of Tybalt gone nuts.
Yeah, maybe a Tybalt or Tybalt that would make the most sense, I think. You know, part of the battle of the Romeo and Juliet, though, is the battle with the knowledge that the audience are bringing with them. You know,
they know how it's going to end.
They know how it's going to end, and they've got their icons and their images in their head of where, you know. And that's why this is so satisfying to do, because you really feel, you know, really palpably in the theatre, through the candlelight, that the audience a lot of them are massively shocked by the directions the play take, in a way that you wish you could achieve with Mercutio's death, but you sort of know when you're doing Mercutio that you can never quite provide them with that dramatic shock, because it's sort of so ingrained in society already, whereas the Begetto death in this is so brilliant, because it's totally left field.
Yes, whereas the last scene, well, we know it's going to end badly for the lovers, and we know it's going to end badly for nearly everybody.
Yeah.
You're still standing at the end,
hand
out some of the punishments. But Giovanni coming in with his sister's heart on a knife. I mean, that's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And
I saw people when I was there, sort of cringing, and the blood on the stage as well. People were really nervous about the blood coming towards them. Whereas you never get that at the Globe. I mean, they practically wash their face in it if they come anywhere near stage blood.
There's a sort of delicacy in there that means that these things really seem to rock people in a way that they maybe don't when they're in the bigger theatre. But yeah, he comes through the audience with the heart, and you see people trying to compute the image, and he's covered in blood and the heart. And it's one of those things, it's quite a difficult scene to act in something, you know. Because I don't really speak in it for a long time. You know, he appears and he comes on, and it's so violent and horrible. It's quite difficult to know how to respond, you know. But you sort of have to assume that it would have been so difficult to believe and compute as indeed the characters in the scene seem to struggle with it a bit to work out what's happened. But it's a really powerful image, and the audience, it's wonderful to watch them squirm.
Yes, because the last thing you would expect, really, is that he would kill Annabella and then show that he's done so in such a horrible way.
Yeah, yeah. I sort of, again, it's how people see it and who don't know the play, what they think is going to happen, or what the tone that encroaches on the play in that final scene, or when they're on the bed, whether they see that coming at all, whether, you know, I can't say, really. Because I sort of knew that was the one thing I remembered about the play before I did it. I, you know, was the heart and the dagger and the murder at the end and the incest. But what they get the sense of.
Yeah, because what Jimmy's been saying about it being a rather romantic view of love, and I mean, in a sense, they do seem, although according to all the rules they're doing everything that's wrong, they seem to be more innocent than almost everybody else. And then it starts to change.
Yeah, they're all... It's why I like the play so much, I think. They're all believable characters. They're all flawed, and even the innocents, even the lovers, are sort of messed up in their own way. And they're struggling. He's struggling to work out this complex, bizarre feeling that he has for Annabella, and she's, you know, doesn't deal with it right. She treats the suitors quite badly. They're sort of impetuous. They're violent. They don't, you know, and all that messiness really suits them. You know, it seems very human, very believable, even though it's a play that's so grotesque and sort of you couldn't quite believe it on one level. On another, it seems really, really beautifully believable. Every single strand of the story, I think, that's why it seems to work so well.
And then you, Jimmy, get the last line, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of looks as if, oh, this society is a terrible mess, but it's mainly because that woman was a whore, is it?
That's what he says. Yeah, I know. I quite love the last line, the penultimate line in One So Young, So Rich in Nature's Store, having Giovanni's body there and addressing it to Giovanni's body and reflecting that the youth and promise is his, that has been corrupted by a woman, is so patently not true. But of course it's a sort of, and because it's delivered by the person it's delivered who we've already seen excuse a murder, you know, he said he's going to appropriate all the wealth, and it's so massively alienating that I can't but imagine that it is a sort of Brechtian sort of, you know, are we going to put up with this? Because the society that he's depicting in Palmer isn't too different from what's happening here. Women are chattels and they're sold, and their sexuality is owned by their parents and sold to the prospective husbands. And to say that they have behaved as whores when actually society makes them whores by making their sexuality a tradable commodity.
Yeah.
And that's sanctioned by the church. And so, yeah. I mean, it's nice that he gets to distance it with a Catholic cardinal to slightly make everyone feel slightly better, but I'm sure the message is still the same, that, you know, they as a society, and maybe still we too, you know, have got to deal with our attitude to it. I mean, of course it doesn't have the same resonance. I mean, now I think that's why people are so obsessed with this play being about incest and the bloodfest at the end, as opposed to, you know, the real proper socio-political message that Ford is sort of sticking out there, which I think is very interesting.
Mm.
And it's so amazing to see it at that time. Mm. I mean, this goes far further than, we could argue. I mean, Shakespeare, you always can puzzle or wonder what his attitude to the things that he's done are, and how, what his attitude to Shylock is, and what his attitude to women is after Taming the Shrew, and you never quite know, and you can argue and stuff. This you can't argue at all. Ford's nailing his colours to the mast pretty fiercely. This is quite a feminist play, I think. You know, the way he doesn't appear so, because the way he treats Hippolyta, Putana, Annabella is so vicious and extreme, but a group of men standing around at the end sharing out the spoils and saying the whole thing has been caused by a woman who ultimately only ever said when she gets led away by Giovanni. I mean, it seems to me that what happens is Giovanni isn't innocent at all. Giovanni wants to fuck his sister, and he comes forward and attempts to do so. She is worried about his state of mind, and when he asks her what they're going to do, she says, "What you will." She doesn't say, you know, she says, "What you will."
Yeah.
"What you will." And he uses the word will just before. You know, she maybe is some sort of an innocent, but she's not that much of an innocent to not know what his will is. And he is, she's giving in to his, you know, I think there's something more. Ford is doing something there still,
yes.
You know, to point out that women are in the society that they're found in this play, they're made to be what they are by the men. And the fault doesn't lie with them, the fault lies with men. That may be disempowering from a feminist perspective on another level, but nevertheless, in the context of the time, I think Ford's being really quite progressive.
And by the end, Giovanni does seem to be completely mad, which...
yeah.
What can one say?
Yes. Well, what Max does so brilliantly, Max sort of gets...
Max Bennett
who plays Giovanni, you know, he comes on and is, he's sort of zinging and, you know, this sort of frenzied energy that sort of exudes off him all the way through that scene, sort of quivering with sort of adrenaline, whatever it is, you know, he manages to somehow make it... He really brings on stage that story of what he's done to his sister, the extremity of it, and how far he's willing to go and, you know, to take everyone down with him. It's really powerful what he does. But yeah,
kill him on stage. Is that kind of thing technically harder on that small stage, much smaller stage, and with people much closer?
Easier in a way, in the same way that sort of blocking becomes easier because the stage is so small, you know, that sort of things seem to take care of themselves. We do a sword fight in the first scene, and that's quite risky simply because of proximity and swords being quite long, and so being mindful of faces of the audience. But certainly, the sort of mess at the end is sort of, there's only so much you can do. You know, there's only so many places people can die. You know, because you've got a small stage and you've got a big table on it and audience on three sides, and so it's sort of simplifies it nicely, and it means that it's brutally close to people, which you can, you know, certain groundlings at the Globe will get, but a lot of people are far removed from violence. Whereas here, I'm holding the dying Soranzo in my arm, and there's blood pooling around him, and the audience, you know, are, you know, 2 feet away. You know, a lot of them really close to that, and that's really fun to, you know, to play with that dynamic.
One feels that if something went slightly wrong, they wouldn't be as willing to laugh as perhaps they would be at the Globe.
You mean if something went actually wrong with
Maybe some of the blood didn't come out at the right time or whatever. You know?
Yes, no, I think you can get away with a multitude of sins on the Globe stage. You know? It sort of masks a lot of calamity sometimes, but here it's very irised in, you know. Very, I think they've spot a lot more, which means that the detail has to be there, I think, as well.
Well, you're still doing it, and you've still got another week. Has it changed much, Jimmy, since the beginning of this run?
For me personally, hugely.
In what way? What way?
Because I've given myself a lot of license to look around in terms of. You
when
know,
was the director last in?
Well, no, it's not that. I mean, he gave me quite a bit of license, you know. It's, you know, sort of the way I play anyway, but certainly with comedy is, well, one's always sort of shifting and pushing it and finding things and keeping it fresh and slightly dangerous in terms of, you know, letting moments stretch and then speeding them up and you know, playing around with it. I'd hate for a play to be the same at the end of a run as it is at the beginning. You know,
Or even two nights running.
It should be getting better and better and better. But the only way you can make it better and better and better is to risk some nights it not be so good. Mm. You know, because as you get more fleeter and you get better knowledge of it and you get better knowledge of how the audience is reacting, you know, you want to stay ahead of them and you want to keep surprising them and surprising yourself. Otherwise, the thing runs the danger of becoming dead. And it's got to be alive, so you keep shifting and, you know, and as I say, that just does mean that sometimes moments and things go a little bit flat, but you just don't mind them and push on to the next one. And it's the same in any part, I think, isn't it? I mean, one's always just flirting around, and every day, and it is the thing, the wonderful thing about the Globe, both the indoor and the outdoor, again, because you're playing with the audience and creating the story with them. On a given night, an audience will, they're different. They're all looking at each other, they're all feeding off each other, they're everywhere in the Wanamaker, just like in the Globe. Maybe everybody can see an audience member as much as they can see an actor. You can always see somebody else. So they feed and create an atmosphere themselves, whether they know it or not. And that is what we have to play with and can respond to. So by virtue of the architecture, we remain live performers. There's no fourth wall. You can't just create a performance and then just trot it out night after night after night, because work.
You agree with that?
Yeah, very much. Yeah, it's bang on. It's the joy of it, you know. Is that learning and that change that happens? For me, because the part I'm playing, I find that the delicacy for me is about finding variety and finding freshness, but also having to be so rigid with making sure that the story is being served. You know, I feel like my character has to, you know, if the story doesn't make sense, we don't quite follow what he's doing, none of it will make sense. So I'm sort of trying to find a freedom in a play, and also trying to sort of make sure that all the people in that room, some of whom can't see me, you know, at any given point because of the sight lines, whatever it may be, the candlelight.
Yeah, some people are very high up and looking through...
through chandeliers, down onto the stage, or certain parts of it shield certain bits of the stage. You know, making sure that speed and thrust that Ford created so brilliantly in this play is constantly being... I'm stoking that fire all the way along. That's what I feel that sort of function is. And then within that, trying to look... Yeah, you know, I'm looking at the audience a lot, and you look in their eyes and they're different, you know. How they respond, that weird thing where people smile because you just... you're speaking to them, but you've just put a woman's eyes out on stage, and watching their confusion at how you're making them feel, or watching people not want to deal with it, or trying to charm them even though you've done this horrible, you know, that play, that flirting is really delightful in there, and it's really delightful in the Wanamaker because it feels really personal, because you see the whole person in a way that you can't, when you look up to direct a speech to, you know, it might be a bay of people up on the upper gallery of the Globe, and you connect with one person and you sort of unlock that whole bay, it feels. Whereas here it becomes literally person by person by person by person, and that's really exciting.
Well, thank you both very much. I feel I mustn't keep you any longer because you've got to go and get ready to do Tis Pity She's a Whore again. Thank you very much.
Thank you.